culture is simply the story. It's the story you tell about the organization you work in. It's the story your leadership tells. Conversely, it's the story the world's telling about you.
You're listening to the Building a Coaching Culture podcast. If you need to compete and win in the 21st century labor market as an employer of choice, this podcast is for you. Each week, we share leadership development, coaching, and culture development insights from leading experts who are developing world-class cultures in their own organizations. And now, here's your host, J.R. Flatter.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. It's J.R. Flatter with my good friend Lucas. How you doing?
Hello. Buddy? Pretty good.
And today's topic is what we wish we knew 5 years ago. And it's a long, long list. And, you know, I think before you even get started, it's a good exercise to think about this across different topics. What I see a lot of leaders doing is judging people by themselves 5 years ago, or by themselves today, when they're really that person is where they were 5 years ago. I see this come up frequently when someone's leaving one job and their replacement shows up and like, this person's not prepared and they have an entirely different work ethic. And I often ask them, are you comparing them to yourself today or yourself 5 years ago? Because now you have five more years of experience. So I really want you to jump in here because I know you've been coaching about 5 years.
Yeah. The first one, I wrote down a couple, but this is the one that's jumping out at me right now, is that building a new skill doesn't come at the expense of, number one, your identity or your other skills. Like, I used to have this kind of anxiety or fear that, oh, I'm picking this new thing up, so I'm not going to have time for the old thing, and I'm never going to go back to the old thing, or that thing's going to go away, or I'm going to change my personality, identity. So that reticence to kind of pick something new up, that's something that I wish that I knew earlier, because it's in many ways, the intersections between your skills and can be more valuable, like how many programmer coaches are there versus just, you know, other types of coaches or, you know, programmer cartoonist coaches, things like that.
Yeah. So you've hit on a really interesting topic. And I was just talking about this in class yesterday. Imposter syndrome, anxiousness, fear, to use your word, I wrote it down. Unfortunately, I wish I had known 5 years ago, they're never going to go away. So despite all of the coaching and all the coaching education, I mean, I'm giving a presentation 2 days from now. I think you're going to be there. And I've given this presentation dozens of times. And already, at least twice today, I felt butterflies in my stomach thinking about it. And I know, I absolutely know, as I walk onto stage to deliver these remarks, I'm going to have butterflies in my stomach when I do it. And what I realized over the last 5 years, A, that's never going away. And B, it comes from a really good place. So most of us who find ourselves in the coaching world are service oriented in one capacity or another. We want to help others grow. We want to be the best leader we can be. And therefore, it matters a lot to us. So when I go speak to this audience on Friday, I want it to be impactful. And so therefore, I'm lying in bed at night thinking about what joke do I want to tell and what case studies might I use? And it'll all come naturally once I get out there and I have the self-efficacy that I know how to do it and I know it's very likely to go very well. But it doesn't mean that I'm still not going to walk out there Friday morning with butterflies. The challenge is getting yourself to recognize that comes from a very good place and also not letting it overwhelm you. So one of the things you and I say all the time in our training, in our education programs, you have to become comfortable being uncomfortable. And that discomfort, if it goes away, means you've become apathetic, you've stopped growing, probably not a good thing.
Yeah, and I guess it's also the perspective change of like when you're learning how to coach or speak to people, like use emotional intelligence, you're learning to offer somebody something to somebody else. And so it's almost like, you know, you get the discomfort and the anxiety, but hopefully they get something more out of it. So thinking about how you're going to be able to help other people with your skills, like taking away the selfish focus that, you know, humans always want to have.
Yeah. And I guess that's another lesson from the last 5 years, not even further back, but you only have to be 1% better than someone to give them something. So, which is what was going to be my next topic, and that is minimally viable product. So you could look at my face or hear, listen to my voice and tell I'm a boomer. And as I was coming up, you better have it right before you put it in the marketplace. And I was taught for the last several years by you and others of younger generations, your brother, other coaches, our sales lead in Sydney. No, get it out there and see what the market tells you about it. And so I had a great discomfort with that. Our organization had a great discomfort with that. I won't mention anyone by name. I was actually asked, aren't you embarrassed by how poorly this looks? And I thought about it for a minute. I said, no, I'm not. I'm creating value for people, even though it's not perfect and it likely never will be. It's changing people's lives already. So the lesson to coaches is don't wait until it's perfect. Get yourself out there. Start getting your reps. Start building your self-efficacy because you're going to change people's lives while you do that. I just got a page-long email today how disappointed someone was in my class today. And 5 years ago, that would probably have been like, oh no. Today, I'm looking at it and beginning their journey. I've got years and years of experience doing this now, and I'm not blowing it off. We responded back to the individual, but I'm also not changing the education program because of the comment of one individual. I also got tons of positive feedback from the same class. So long way of saying, act rather than planning to act. And I mean by that is get out there, get in the arena, get some blood, sweat, and tears behind you, change people's lives, keep getting better. That same global sales lead yelled at me one day, she's the most gracious person to tell you you're doing something wrong. Stop worrying so much about the website and get yourself out there. Okay. Yeah, so that's a huge lesson for me in the 21st century marketplace.
I think, and this is kind of provable in different domains and different expertise, but like you need feedback to become an expert at anything. So, you know, just thinking about it and doing it behind the scenes and perfecting, that doesn't necessarily involve a lot of feedback. And, you know, you hear that quote, is it a Muhammad Ali, you know, everybody's got a plan to beat me, yeah. Mike Tyson, until they get punched in the face. And it's like, okay, that's obviously like, you know, I'm going to beat you up kind of thing. But think about it from the other person's perspective. Like you kind of need to get punched in the face to,
absolutely,
you know, to improve.
Yeah. John Bumhofer, who's our, what do we call John? Our producer? Podcast consultant.
Producer.
Maybe he should answer that question. Anybody wants world-class help doing a podcast, reach out to John. But he just said 15 minutes ago, he's an entrepreneur and been in the marketplace, I don't know how long. We've been working with him for several years. You don't know until you get out there what the real challenges are and what it's going to feel like and taste like and how you're going to respond. In our education programs, we call it jumping off the 10-meter tower. You got to jump off the tower again and again and again to get that taste in your mouth. So one of the things I've been thinking about a lot, I'm not sure that I know what to call them yet, because it's the majority of the world. I read a study a couple of days ago that 84% of every human being will resist change. And you could apply that to the coaching world too. So 84 out of every 100 people you have a coaching conversation with are going to look at you like, what? it's our obligation as coaches and as coach educators to communicate to them what this coaching thing's all about, what the return on investment's going to be. And so in that regard, I guess what I'm really trying to say is it's a business. Whether you're doing it as your style of leadership or whether you're doing it as your source of income, you have to make it part of your strategic communication plan, telling the story again and again and again and not being disappointed or frustrated that almost everybody you talk to doesn't really understand what it is you're telling them.
Yeah, I've had that experience personally in the last couple of years where you can collect, even personally, your messaging, you can collect all these ideas and sometimes they immediately go somewhere and you develop it and create something, and other times they go by the wayside. But more often than not, the ones that are forgotten about get revisited. You know, so even you're sharing a message with other people, they might either brush it off or in one ear out the other, or, you know, you don't think that there's anything gained by it. But then maybe a year from now, you hear that person saying the same thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It happens every day in class. It happens every day in parenting and grandparenting. Your children start to parrot things that you've told them. Your sister standing up at the dinner table and saying, "Daddy, isn't it illegal not to go to college?" Part of me was super proud of her, but part of me was thinking, maybe the message was a little too strong. Yeah, you have to communicate, 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 to borrow a phrase from John Cotter in Leading Change. And the world tells us all no, again, again, and again. So one of my favorite parts of Robert Gates' book on leadership, which I mention all the time, it's Secretary of Defense, Director of the CIA, and the President of Texas A&M all in one lifetime. And you wonder how a guy like that could be such a successful leader across such diverse organizations. At the end of the day, you're leading human beings. We're coaching human beings. And human beings are naturally resistant to change. And the world tells us all no. It doesn't matter where we grew up, what our education is, how beautiful your idea is. You know, I was thinking about that this morning. Even the most successful companies in the world advertise and have marketing programs and social media platforms. And you might ask yourself, if they're so good and everybody in the world knows them, why are they spending money on that? Well, the world's still telling them no. They still have competitors beating at their door. Every unicorn there is, and we could mention them, they were a startup at one time, and everybody was telling them no, and they still continue to tell them no. Competitors emerge. You know, there's talk about ChatGPT being a Google killer. I see Google responding, got a little bit of hiccups, but that's a minimally viable product that they put out there, and we'll see what they do with the findings. So you can't be afraid to be in the arena as a minimally viable product and having people shout from you comfortably seated in the shade of their cushioned seat, "Throw the ball farther, throw it straighter," like the email I received this afternoon.
Yeah, even there's that whole, there's a concept like of marketing myopia where, you know, you become complacent with your place in the market, or, you know, you're Coca-Cola and you say, you know, we sell carbonated sugar drinks, but, you know, people are now drinking seltzer and all this other things. And how do you use your apparatus or your skills to make something for them or target them? You know, like everything's changing constantly. So your messaging has to change and your product has to change.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, hopefully, yeah. You won't change Coca-Cola's formula because that doesn't work.
Oh, but no, we knew that from the 1980s. Huge failure. So also, again, looking back 5+ years for this one, the importance of emotional intelligence in the 21st century marketplace. And there's a relationship here between, and I don't know whether it's a Venn diagram or it's a triumvirate or whatever it is, there's a relationship between the 21st century technologies, the boomers such as myself that are lingering around the labor market, the Gen Zs that are coming into their own, and our different ages. So you could think about that as all coming together in the 21st century marketplace and agreeing and disagreeing with each other, telling stories about each other, complaining about each other. But it's also a millennials old challenge. Cavemen complained about the slothfulness of the youth of today. Shakespeare wrote about it in 1599 in the Seven Acts of Life. And I've been in the marketplace long enough to have seen it happen a couple of times. When I was growing up, the greatest generation was in charge. And now, as you grew up, the boomers were in charge. Now, as you're coming into your 30s, you're seeing the Gen Zs come up. And so you're seeing it a couple of times already in your lifetime. And if you look close enough at the discussions, it's a relationship between, yeah, things are different, but they're the same as well. And you're at a different place in your life journey than you were 15 years ago, and the people are 15 years younger than you are at a different place in their life's journey. And so if you look at Lencioni and the five dysfunctions of a team, trust is at the very bottom of that. And right above it is, are we willing to argue with each other in good faith? He doesn't say it exactly like that, but if you don't have conflict in your organization and you're not wondering what were they thinking, you probably don't have the trust you need. And if you're not willing to talk about those things. And so in our education programs, one of our metaphors is one and one thing you loved and one thing you thought could have been done better. And that goes straight back to Lencioni and our willingness to have those conversations with each other and not make it personal and do it on behalf of the team. And for me, a big maturation was the importance of emotional intelligence in the 21st century labor market. And I tell our customers, so even Gen Xs have hesitancy towards emotional intelligence and people younger, people from all generations that haven't yet been convinced of the value of emotional intelligence. And I know for my own coaching and for our coaching education programs, it's front and center as to 21st century labor market. Are we willing and able to have those conversations? Are we making our well-being part of our leadership and the well-being of those that we lead, those that we work alongside, and not scoffing at the ideas of mindfulness and a growth mindset and doing things in new ways that might be uncomfortable without a fight? I tell a lot of my customers, you can go into the 21st century kicking and screaming, or you can go standing upright with your pride. But it's going to happen. And, you know, when do you decide to get on board? When you're grasping at your last straws or while you're still healthy and able to voluntarily jump on board?
Yeah, I mean, with the emotional intelligence, I think it's applicable to the, you know, things changing all the time, to the different generations. Like, I see it being a parent. And, you know, I think if I'm doing everything right, you know, in making the best decisions, then if there's like a negative reaction, then it's my son's problem or, you know, my wife's problem. And now I have a different perspective. Like, no, like, you know, I could be doing everything right, but they can still have a problem. And, you know, like, for example, with like a child, like a tantrum or something, there we mentioned like you only have to be 1% better than somebody else. Like his 100% like capacity to deal with like problems has been reached, and now he's at his breaking point. And I'm thinking like, you know, this is absurd. This is ridiculous. You know, this is about ice cream or something silly. But just trying to have that, you know, patience and understanding and forgiveness, and going back to even being more selfless, like, you know, I'm hurt by this, or, you know, I'm frustrated by this, but so is the other person, you know. So, and we all have to get through this together.
Thanks for that. Yeah, I guess one of the last things for me is I've learned to be unapologetic. And I was taught this by three of our student coaches. So I was mentoring a cohort, and one day, for whatever reason, only three showed up out of the group, and I decided to let them coach me as an exercise to watch them coach, because that's what mentor coaching is all about. In small groups, me, the mentor, watching students coach. So I said, coach me. And so for an hour, the three of them coached me, took turns asking questions and following the fundamentals of coaching. The next question has to be relevant and has to leaning towards discovery. And in that single session, I wrote down at least six discoveries. And one of the discoveries, and I shared it with them, why would I ever be apologetic for helping to educate the three magnificent coaches that had just coached me for an hour? And so in your coaching practice, whether it's for profit or part of your leadership, whether you're an internal coach or an external coach, is to be unapologetic about this magnificent basket of knowledge, skills, abilities, and experiences that you have. And as you're communicating to the world and serving as an ambassador of coaching, to be unapologetic about it, because you do have significant value to deliver. And I guess this does fall a bit in line with our characteristic of being unreasonable. One of the characteristics in our house of leadership that we teach is to be positively unreasonable. And being positively unreasonable means you have expectations that you can change the lives of the people you coach, because you can. And I see it happen every day. I've been fortunate enough to deliver that kind of life-changing coaching on multiple occasions. Doesn't happen in every session, doesn't happen with every leader. I would say if you keep chipping away at the boulder, you're going to change everybody you interact with. The fourth slide in every deck we teach, or every program we teach, is this journey is going to change your life. And that's me walking the walk of being absolutely unapologetic. When I got that negative feedback, which feedback's a gift, she was right. I talked for the entire session about whatever came to mind that I thought was relevant to the cohort and where they were in their maturation. So she was right. We didn't talk about the topic of the day at all, but I still delivered, in my mind's eye, good, solid coach education that aligned to the ICF core values and ethics and keeping a coaching mindset. So I felt 100% comfortable, but it doesn't mean I'm completely dismissing the feedback. I told the facilitator for tomorrow, please maximize your coaching time tomorrow, because they didn't get an opportunity to coach today. It was entirely my fault, but I still don't think it was time wasted.
Kind of something we talk a lot about is with being a novice and like embracing this frustrating feeling and you know, encouraging yourself to kind of be bad at something so you can get better at it. But to sum up, like sometimes like you have to do things or believe things that are counterintuitive to grow. Like your intuition is limited to whatever experiences you have. And if you want to, you know, gain new experiences and skills and knowledge, then you have to step outside your comfort zone and do something that seems, you know, unintuitive. It doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem comfortable. But like 5 years later now, it's like, oh, like all of the things that I value now in terms of my growth have been things that, you know, felt really awkward at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when you first start coaching, it seems rather formulistic. We show you the 8 competencies. We show you the how to ask a powerful question, and then you do it the first time. And you know, you and I have drawn an arc of the coaching session and a similar arc of the coaching relationship. And they look at that arc, and they're laying the baseline, they're in the heart, and then they're closing. And it just seems so formulistic. But then they create change in somebody's life. And they go, oh. So the beginning of every class, we celebrate discoveries and we spend a few minutes of mindfulness. And as recently as this morning, somebody celebrated they had created change in somebody's life. It sort of just happened and they were celebrating that. We were celebrating with them. And my comment is always, your coaching's never going to be the same. You now have a self-efficacy that you didn't have before you had that conversation. So the last thing I'd like to drag into the room is, I wish I had a stronger appreciation 5 years ago for the relationship between culture and coaching and a coaching style of leadership for the 21st century. So in this global labor market, largely virtual, we're all struggling to attract and retain the world's best talent. Restaurants are understaffed. Businesses are understaffed. We're all out there competing for that world-class talent. And it isn't compensation that's going to attract and retain them. You simply would be non-competitive in the marketplace. And if you do run a business for any length of time, you'll realize a raise or a bonus, the half-life of either one is measured in minutes, probably, or days at most. And the half-life of somebody's joy upon getting hired, similarly short, comma, if you don't have the culture that's going to attract them and retain them. You can't pay them enough. You can't get beyond that half-life without a world-class 21st century culture. And I'm absolutely convinced it's a coaching style of leadership. And I wish I had realized that a long time ago, because it could have injected it into our coaching and coaching education programs. You know, and you're much closer to the young generation than I am, how important that is to them. You're now having the oldest person in the room experiences and being looked at like, really? Which happens to me on a daily basis.
Yeah, and I think I was thinking about in terms of like growing your skills, but I think it applies here as well. Like when you join a new position and when you're like learning a new thing, your growth and your perception of how skilled you are not going at the same rate. So you could be getting more skilled at your job and like doing better every day, but your perception of how you're doing could be like very low. And at a certain point you feel like, oh, you know, I am doing well, but the whole time you were taking one step at a time to get to that point. And I think they call it like the Dunning-Kruger curve. And I don't know what the etymology of that is, but it gets mentioned a lot with building skills. Like you feel very good about it at the beginning. Then there's like a years long doldrum, and then your confidence comes back eventually. But if you're, yeah, at first, yeah, you're getting hired and you feel like very confident. And then, so I guess maybe that coaching culture can help remind people, you know, you might perceive it this way, but I'm seeing these things, you know, I'm seeing your growth.
To break it down a little bit in the last couple of minutes together, culture is simply the story. You could spend an entire book talking about culture, and I've read a lot of books, I'm sure you have as well, on culture. But I think where the rubber meets the road, culture is simply the story. It's the story you tell about the organization you work in. It's the story your leadership tells, your marketing tells, your sales lead tells about your company and your products. Conversely, it's the story the world's telling about you. And is the world telling a story? They're going to be interested in your personal and professional achievement. You're going to be respected as a human being. Now you're going to be asked to work hard, show up on time, and be respectful of each other, perhaps, I would hope. But beyond that, there's some flexibility on the hours, there's flexibility on virtual and in person, flexibility on how you dress and how you wear your hair. Because all of those are wants, not needs. The needs are what are existential for the business to survive, the organization to succeed. All right, my friend. Any last minute thoughts as we head out?
No, that was good stuff.
Well, that concludes this episode of Building a Coaching Culture. I truly hope that this episode was helpful to you. If it was, be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. Maybe stop and give us a rating or review, and share this podcast with someone who might find it helpful as well. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.